Interface. Not the same questions, not the same answers.
Hello, I'm Brad Johnson, and welcome to Interface, an examination of Christian perspectives on theology, philosophy, ethics, and culture with Adam Ayers, the pastor of Disciples Church in Costa Mesa, California, and the founder of the Stoa Foundation. And joining us in the studio today is our regular guest, Tom Dunn, and our special guest today is Father Michael Manning. We haven't had Father Michael Manning on the show for a while. It's good to have him back. He's been involved in media ministry for over 25 years now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I know that it was tough getting you scheduled in here because you've been running all around the world.
I have. I've been a lot of travel. Yeah, it's been amazing.
You just got back from Ireland, but before that you were in Africa.
I was in Africa for a month in Africa, visiting the countries of Ghana and Cameroon, which is on western part of Africa, kind of in the middle, and visiting missionaries and seeing all kinds of people, members of my community. I'm a member of a religious community. There are about 6,000 of us around the world that go mainly where Christ has not been preached. And many of them had gone to Ghana. And I'd heard about that since I was 14 years old and heard the stories of missionaries. So it was a fabulous chance to get in and see this great work in very, very difficult situations. I'm extremely comfortable in my world right now, and that was a real threat to me in seeing the extremes of cultural change, the extremes of food, of climate, malaria, bad roads, poor education, and saying, wow, look at this, what they give up to preach the gospel. I was overwhelmed. I was in Cameroon, which is close to that, giving a retreat to priests. In the United States, in the Catholic Church, the number of priests is very, very small in comparison to what it was 30 years ago. The numbers are going down. Seminaries are not filled the way they used to be. But in Africa, the church is blossoming and growing in phenomenal ways. For example, in Cameroon, in the diocese of Kumbo, that's where I was, they have right now, they have 40 priests in that diocese. And at this very moment, they have 66 major seminarians. And that means that like within the next 3 to 4 years, they're going to be ordained priests coming in. So the prospect of growth is unbelievable what happens. But then there are other situations where, especially with the real struggle with Islam, there are some real tough things going on. Islam is very strong, and it's growing very much too. And there's a real battle going on and for the souls and the hearts of people of Africa between Christianity and Islam. It's a very acute thing. I met a bishop. He had just been made a bishop, who was assigned to a church that has 0.05 Christians in his area. You know, that kind of situation. Whereas you can go to others where it's going, but it's a very, very, well, this is not necessarily Islam, but it's also native religion. They speak of the native religion, which they've been living with it for centuries. This is their theology and their relationship with God. But this bishop living in that situation, there are 9 priests, and I said, well, you know, what have you got? And he said, well, we have a church. And I says, well, what about your living thing? Well, he says, I've got a bedroom and another room, and that's where I live. And I said, oh, wow, that's tough. And he says, I do have a car. He says, I don't have a telephone. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know. Wow, what a difference in approach and in simplicity and fire and, oh, but a great thing.
A friend of mine who's a pastor up north, Northern California, makes frequent trips to Sudan, Southern Sudan.
Oh, my. That's tough.
Yeah, he talks frequently about raiding armies.
Yes.
Of cavalry that come down,
yes,
from Northern Sudan regularly and trash all of the Christian villages.
And slavery.
Yeah.
We pride ourselves in, you know, getting rid of slavery here in our country and other places. But it's going on now in Sudan, slavery. Mm-hmm. You know, they come in and they take the Christian people away. And if you want to pay some money, you can free these people. Yeah. Very, very sensitive thing. Mm-hmm. We don't hear a lot about that. We don't. You know,
we don't.
We haven't heard. And it's amazing how we can be so selective in our media about hearing things that, that are perhaps a little bit more advantageous to us as a government and to our American way of life, that other situations we don't hear about so much. You know? Ah, scary, scary situations. One of the things that I found, can I go on?
One of the things that I found interesting in Africa,
never been to Africa before. Boom, you know, here I am. You know, this guy from California goes to Africa. I didn't know what to expect. I thought maybe it was going to be all bush huts and whatnot. But I came to Accra, which is the capital of Ghana, and it's a wonderful city. You know, there are actually cars and things. And I didn't know what I was going to thinking, you know, and there are traffic jams and things like that. But there are wonderful, wonderful, warm people. The word that you hear over and over again is, you are welcome. My whole month in Africa was that you are welcome. And it's a sincere thing. They really offer a welcome, even though your color is different than theirs. It's a rich country, both Cameroon and Ghana. But well, several things that really frightened me were terrible roads. And oh gosh, when I got on the freeway to come here and do the show, you know, you just drive, you know, you can drive the speed limit and everything. But, oh, driving in Ghana and Cameroon, you're continually going, if there's any cement on the road, between potholes, and then there's going to be dirt roads. They're going to be just terrible. And it drives you nuts because you know that that is hamstringing the people, because if you don't have good roads, you can't move produce and you can't move products around. And so it kind of is like the way of a government of just kind of keeping people backward, keeping them unable to be able to get a level that would be. But we're not looking for all the opulence that we have here in the United States, but there are problems like in Cameroon where there were teachers that hadn't been paid for 5 months. Get this, you know, hadn't been paid for 5 months. And so all their only way of existence was going out and working on a farm and getting the food that they had there and coming back. Imagine that. You know, not getting paid for, well, as an actor, you might know that, Tom, when you don't get paid for 5 months. But you work on your farm and that's your... But it's a scary thing. And then, not only that, but it's education-wise. They're being held back, and the restrictions are that. And so the blessings that we have of going to a junior college in Ghana, for example, there are only 3 universities. And as I talked to some people who are in the upper schools, only 10% of, like, our high school graduates are able to go on.
So, Father, you found that it was really, I mean, there was a real problem with people actually being held down
very much
from,
so. Yeah.
Progressing
economically wild. And then also medically. Oh gosh, in Cameroon, terrible stories of people not wanting to go to hospitals and so dying at home because they might be able to do something for you in the hospital in terms of good medical care of an operation that they needed, but the aftercare, they don't do that. So if you're in rehabilitation in a hospital, your relatives have to come and bring you food. They have to clean the sheets, and they even have to take the refuse out of the toilets to make sure it's clean. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what kind of life is that? And yet that's the mentality of where they are. And so the people just so opposed to that indignity will be dying, you know, dying in their homes. And missionaries told me several times of getting calls because in many of these villages where they're, the missionary is the only one that has a car, a four-wheel drive, frequently getting calls at 4 o'clock in the morning, would you please take so-and-so to the hospital, and so having to go and drive because that was the only vehicle, and people afraid to go to the hospital because that was the last step. But, oh, gosh, a neat thing. Christ is alive. The evangelical movement in Accra and throughout Ghana is very, very strong. Ooh, very, very strong. You go down the street. We would drive down Accra at Saturday nights, and oh, there'd be preachers and crowds of people standing around in the night as the preacher be just, you know, yelling and shouting, and the people were just all excited. And you'd travel. I went up north to a place called Tamale, which is to the north of Accra. And as we drove this 8-hour drive through these terrible roads that were dirt and potholes and whatnot, inevitably, as we would pass through villages, I saw at least 3 signs of evangelical churches, 3 different evangelical churches in the thing, so that there's a real strong movement of the Lord and a desire.
Do you find the Catholic missionaries there working well with the evangelicals?
Yes and no. It's hard to kind of generalize with that. I think that there's a, I don't think there's struggle. There, whenever you have kind of moving into your turf and you don't have the luxury of pluralism that we have here in the United States, we kind of take that for granted because we've lived in that world so much. You know, oh, you're evangelical. Oh, I'm Catholic. Oh, you know, you're Jewish even. You know, we can even see that. The thing about Muslims here, that's a good question. I need to remember this, though. The one priest that I was with in Tamale was very ecumenical and very open in working this. He said that there's a difference in Islam. He said that the Muslims who had lived with them and that they had worked together were fine. He said, but there's been a strong movement in the last 5 to 10 years of people coming from Saudi Arabia with a much more radical bent towards Islam. And you could even hear some of this is what you go on with the persecution of Catholics and especially, well, of Christians and Catholics in Indonesia, the biggest Muslim country in the world. The influence of a radical Islamic direction has become very disruptive. This one missionary told the story of that they lived together in peace and really working together in a good way. And then all of a sudden they came in and, boom, they came through and they tore down 300 of the businesses, small businesses. The Muslims came down and just ripped them all up in the town of Tamale up north. So I'm saying yes and no. And it all depends on a mutual understanding and respect too. You know, you need that mutual respect. And a lot of times there's a real defensiveness that happens.
It must be a great temptation to not want to take arms against this militant aggression against the Christian church.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I can almost sympathize with crusaders in the year, you know, 1057 that said, someone has to do something about this, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's take arms against this. It's a struggle to not give in to that kind of retaliation, you know?
Sure it is. And the difficulty that arises is if in the course of this, someone you love is killed, all of a sudden the stakes are completely changed. And what does it mean to turn the other cheek? What does it mean to go the extra mile in that context? And I felt myself entering into that. The need, for example, not only to defend yourself as a Christian, but to defend yourself as a man from Cameroon who finds that there's been a turn in the political world and that a just election has been overturned. Mm. And you want to stand up for the justice of Christ to say, this is wrong. And as a Christian, you know, you're doing this as a Christian. And I think that's where we need to keep thinking the connection between that and this thing, oh boy, you know. And then being beaten up and tortured because you spoke against the government that's going on because of the election inequality. You know, again, I think the democracy aspect of Christianity and the respect that we need to have of other people because of democracy is the connection between that and Christianity is very alive. Mm. Do I make sense?
Yes, you make perfect sense.
So we struggle in the Catholic Church, not so much anymore with a thing called liberation theology, which you heard a lot of in Latin America, when there were just so many, many bad things happening on a political level. The question came from groups who would get together in prayer and read the Bible and find that Jesus was also demanding justice, that it isn't right that people don't have an education. It isn't right that they don't have medical care. It isn't right that they don't have good roads that are going to allow jobs to grow. And so Christianity started to move on a social bent, not with a desire to bring necessarily violence, but to highlight the need that Christianity also demands the right to justice. you've got to be, as a Christian, willing to stand up and say this is wrong, and even being willing to die for it. We have in my community, I mentioned to you, four people on the process in the Catholic Church of becoming saints. We speak of certain people who have lived a life of great virtue, and we put them up on a pedestal to look at their lives and say, wow, this is going to help me to follow Jesus in a better way. And so we look at them at that. Four of the men who were killed during the Nazi regime, one was beheaded, one was crushed to death, one was shot, and one was drowned. they got caught up in a social world that was terrible. You know, the Nazi regime. And as Catholic, three priests and one brother, they got caught up and they were killed. And gosh, that's part of Christianity too. That's part of sainthood, of standing up even as Bonhoeffer might do and saying, this is wrong. You know, this is wrong for the social injustice that's happening. Well, I know we're getting into that, but again, I come to that. By no means an expert in Africa. Please don't think that I'm a 1 month wonder here, but these are some of the things that stood out in my mind that kind of pricked my conscience and challenged me to make sure that my Christianity, realizing that the foundations of evangelization oftentimes are not just the nice things, but the real working, hard work that the missionaries do to bring the gospel in situations where there might not be the brotherhood and sisterhood that you and I experience here as we share our faith, but can allow you to be who you are and I who I am.
A couple of things come to mind that I would just like to hear your thoughts and some information, too, on. One, you mentioned that there is a kind of a passing of liberation theology. Do you see that as a good thing, as a bad thing? What do you see happen with that and why?
The problem with liberation theology was that it oftentimes moved with a Marxist agenda, if you will. And the officials of the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul, came out very strongly against the Marxist idea of that. And he said this in Mexico. He said, it's not wrong to be rich. And I think that's important to say. Oftentimes when you get into a Marxist situation, it's, you know, get rid of the rich. And, you know, it's that class that we need to get rid of. And the Holy Father is saying, wait a minute, no, there's something very good in people being rich because with the riches they have, they're able to help people that don't have. But if the challenge is not putting down the rich, but it's making sure we challenge them to be people who share. So that's the distinction, I think. So, well, when you talk about liberation theology, you have to admit of the strong social and political involvement of John Paul in Poland with the whole movement of rocking the boat to such an extent that communism started to crumble with his support of solidarity with the labor movement in Poland. Well, that's a real political involvement. But again, he's saying, let's make sure that we're active in bringing social justice, but at the same time, we're not allowing class distinctions to become class wars, but that we can respect different classes and challenge the rich as we challenge the poor to work together.
That's obviously a very precarious kind of road.
Sure it is.
How do you see the church negotiating that?
Well, I think if you can look at John Paul, he just needs to keep knocking on the doors of the powerful people. For example, in Cameroon, there's a man by the name of Paul Bai, who's a former Catholic seminarian, I think, who's the leader, that's being challenged continually by the church of not really taking care of the educational needs, not taking care of the medical needs, not taking care of the roads, and so much of the whole world. It's a challenge. How do you do it? You challenge. You come and say, you know, what you're doing is wrong. And if you are rich, your richness is not supposed to be something in which you just kind of feather your bed and you feel good. But you've got to hear the challenge of the eye, you know, getting through the eye of the needle and the challenge of what it means to be poor. But again, making sure that we don't allow the distinctions to be things that say, I'm good and you're bad. No, you know, or I'm better than you are because I'm poor. No, that's not the basis of what Christianity is about. It's respecting where everyone is, but challenging everyone. We realize, yes, I'm poor, but I've also have the challenge of using my talents in order to improve myself and my family's situation and the world's situation too.
Something else that comes to mind as you were speaking earlier, seems to be a very delicate balance between resist not an evildoer and the voice of Christianity for justice. How do we go about that? At least in your eyes.
Now, what do you
mean
by resist not the evildoer?
Here's a mandate. If someone takes your cloak, give them your undershirt.
Yes.
You know, if someone makes you go 1 mile, you go two.
Yes.
How do we simultaneously resist and oppose oppression and fulfill our Christian obligation of turning the other cheek?
Well, what does turning the other cheek mean? For me, it enters into the deep, deep commitment to be willing to forgive. And that's tough. And that's kind of forgiving out of my heart. If there's an opposing army that's coming in, an occupational army that's pushing me around, I have to come with a certain sense of not allowing the evil that they're inflicting on me to be a burden to me. But at the same time, if I'm really going to love myself and I'm going to love the people with whom I live, I'm going to have to do what I can to oppose that. I really don't believe in physical violence as the way of turning that around. But I do believe in the challenge of words and actions, and oftentimes the blood of martyrs, to be able to affect the change. Christianity speaks of that. And I don't think we're called to have Uzis to straighten out a terrible injustice in the that's not the answer. That's not the answer. I think Gandhi said it. I think a lady by the name of Dorothy Day, a Catholic lady, said it. It's the willingness to live the life that we feel Christ has called us to, which is an embracing of poverty and love for the poor, but at the same time being willing to stand up and say, this is wrong. And gosh, here I am doing television, as you said, Brad, for 25 years, but the comfort of television is I can just stand and hear on radio, I can say all these things. But the real challenge comes, are you willing to perhaps go to the, is it Fort Benning, where they have the School of the Americas, where Latin American military people are trained to do bad things. And so that we have people who are in jail right now because they stood up and they're saying, stop this School of the Americas. This is wrong. And they're going to jail. It's certainly not strange to the gospel story or to the epistle story to find jail a common home of a person who stands up for what they think Christ believes in. That basically is where we're coming from. How do we do it? We pray. We make sure that in our own hearts we're not filled with an anger or a lack of forgiveness, but at the same time we're willing to say the words of Jesus, which you're a hypocrite, you're a whitened sepulcher, to power people. The scribes and the Pharisees were the power structure, and he confronted them and said, you're doing wrong things, and he itemized what they were doing wrong.
You know, Father, you said something very disturbing, that the road to obedience to Christ is sometimes paved with the blood of martyrs. That means my blood.
Amen, brother.
It means your blood and his blood.
It does,
and Brad's blood over there. And I don't like that very much. Yeah.
Well, this one of these men, for example, he was a simple brother in a place working in a printing press. And what had happened 3 years before, some anti-Nazi things were printed. Well, several people were arrested and put in jail. He wasn't, but he heard about this. And so the question came, I think I'm going to give up my life. And so he went to the officials and said, I'd like to take the place of the people and the families that are here being held in prison. And they let the others go, and he took it. And 3 years later, they chopped his head off. Boy, that's the road of Christianity. And there are times when it has to happen too, even with regard to moving away from my Christian ideal of a church situation, of maintaining the freedom, maybe of even joining the military. You know, that's another aspect of people willing to give their lives to maintain the freedom that people don't have. I think we were struggling with Kosovo, the religious freedom of these people and the rights of not being slaughtered. And well, military people went in there. I don't see that as anti-Christian. I see that as a Christian approach too. But there's even a reflection of the blood. It's the same blood, but it's a caring and loving of people and wanting to give them freedom and the right. So even though it wasn't an overtly religious situation, it was if it came out of a good heart rather than an economic betterment of the United States or whatnot, but a concern for individuals. That could be that martyr's blood too. Yeah.
It really is strange how quickly we want a pragmatic end to things that leaves us unmarked and unscathed. And yet not even God could come up with one that left him unscathed. Apparently the road to God's compassion is paved with his own blood too. And somehow we don't like that either. You know, that's an uncomfortable part for us. And we want a nice, clean, tidy, push a button from a distance kind of a thing in many of these situations. Like you say, Father Mike, it is such that God calls us to more and really to follow in the path of his sacrifice. And that sits uneasily with all of us. And we'd kind of like you to maybe sacrifice another half hour of your time and talk with us some more, if you don't mind.
Love to. Yeah.
So we're going to...
As long as you listen to me, my gosh.
Yeah, it'd be great. It'd be great to... I want to hear more of your opinions on this, and we can record a show and then play it next week for all of our listeners.
Yeah, because as much as we'd like to, we can't come to an answer for all these questions or exhaust them in our mere 30 minutes here. You've been listening to Interface. Our guest today has been Father Michael Manning. Very honored to have him here again, and we will have him with us again on our next show. Also, thanks to Tom Dunn and to Adam Ayers for sharing time here in the booth with us.